You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Tuesday, August 23rd, 2022, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santamaria.
Howdy.
And Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
Evan has a thing, a family thing, so he's not here this week. And I'm just getting back from Italia, my Italy trip with my family.
It was
awesome. Totally awesome.
The pictures are wonderful.
All right, Steve, what was the best thing you did and the best meal that you had?
All right. Well, the best thing was just hanging with my family. Totally. I mean, that's 100%.
Lame answer.
True. It's not lame. It's true.
It
it's
is like, lame.
But both of my daughters are adults, mostly living outside the house. And so we got to hang as a family for the first time in a long time. So that was the best thing. But the best touristy thing I did was climbing the Duomo of the Basilica in Florence.
Nice.
Jay, you didn't do that when you were there.
I didn't. The line was too long. And
you got to buy skip the line tickets. That's what we did. You got to buy skip the line tickets. Yeah, the line's massive. Just buy the tickets where you get to go right up.
Well, there was another thing too, I'll tell you, because when I went, it was last October and COVID was like much worse back then because, you know.
Yeah.
So we were definitely doing a crowd avoidant behavior.
Yeah.
And that was one of them.
Because you were in a very claustrophobic closed stone stairwell.
You can't.
457 steps. It's a workout, but it's totally worth it. When you get to the top, there's nothing higher in Florence. You get a 360, view of all of Florence and the surrounding Tuscan countryside. It's absolutely gorgeous. When you get up there, everyone said this is 100% worth it going up.
Now, is it true that they give you a free cannoli when you get up to the top?
They should, but no.
All right, your best thing was that, and now the best meal. This is the important one.
All right, so here's the thing. The first night, we flew into Rome, right? We spent a few days in Rome. So we get there. We've been traveling all day. It was like a long flight. We're tired. It's late at night. It's especially late. For us, it was 3 a.m. So we literally went into the first restaurant we saw. No research, nothing. It's like, all right, this is just our first meal. No, zero expectations. It was the best freaking meal we had in the whole trip.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
I
shut your mouth the first day.
The cacio e pepe.
That's awesome.
It was the best cacio e pepe I've had. I tried it two other times, so I had three samples. That was the best one. So first, the bucatini, the pasta, was perfectly cooked. It was perfectly al dente. And, just the proportion of the cheese and the pepper and everything was just perfect. The other times, the second time I had it, they went a little too heavy on the pepper. The third time I had it in Florence, they was like, where's the pepper? It was all way too cheesy and not peppery enough. That's one of those recipes. You got to completely dial it in. But my big question was, how did I get to be 58 years old and never have cacio e pepe before? How did we miss that?
Wait, what the hell is it?
What do you mean? You've never had cacio e pepe?
No.
That's my favorite dish.
Yeah, it's
I know. It's awesome.
It's remarkable.
Comfort food, right? It's the epitome of comfort food.
Oh,
it's incredibly simple. It's pasta.
I've had pasta.
That essentially has some type of butter sauce, but there is a lot of black
butter
pepper.
Sauce.
It's Romano cheese, grated Romano cheese, and crushed black pepper. I looked up a recipe, and it's 18 steps to the recipe. It's not simple. The recipe is really hard to make. You have
to
cacio stir fry the pepper, the ground pepper, and then you mix in the cheese, and you cook the pasta very al dente, and then you put that in the pan with the pepper. Then you put the water from the pasta water, into the pot until the pasta is perfectly cooked, and then. Whatever it's a complicated, which is why I think only certain restaurants have it completely dialed in.
Although in Italy it's pretty common, right? Because it's very
It's a Rome dish. It's a classic Rome dish.
It's like a rustic class. It's like a grandmother dish.
Yeah,
every family does it the way that they do it. But it's literally translates to cheese and pepper.
Yeah, cheese
cacio
and pepper.
Pepe.
Cacio
That's
e
all
pepe.
It is.
Totally.
Oh, it's the best.
Very, very good. I had the best pesto of my life in Cinque Terre.
Really. Jesus.
Usually, I like pesto, but usually when I get it, I'm disappointed halfway through because it's a little bit too much. This was perfect pesto. I could have had three plates of it, it was awesome. So from Rome, we went to Cinque Terre, which is, there's five towns. That's the Cinque, built on the side of the of a cliff. This was just our relaxing vacation, although quote unquote relaxing meant climbing up and down a cliff at five times a day. And then we went to Florence to finish up the trip. So it was really good because it was three
Did you
very
see David.
Of course, it was three very different experiences. Rome is like a modern city with ruins scattered about, right? And it's awesome. So you basically just go looking at all the ruins. Went to the Colosseum, the Palatine Hill, which I kept calling Palpatine Hill, you know.
Of course you did.
Of course. And then the Pantheon, and just you walking down the street and there's another ruin, you know. It's like, it's just amazing. The best was
a rune or a ruin?
A ruin, not a ruin. And the best was Palatine Hill, which we did not go to when we were there in high school, guys. Then we sort of had the more of like beachy, relaxing, just so Cinque Terre, it looks like you're in a town that was built 500 years ago. It's just so quaint, so beautiful, and it's like a little fishing village, you know. Looks like it's out of a Disney movie. That's where I had the pesto. That was awesome. And then Florence is completely different still. Florence is like a Renaissance city. And
I remember.
Yeah, and it's the whole like inner city is looks like it did, you know, hundreds of years ago to when the Medici's were building, you know, were ruling there and building it up as a Renaissance city. And it's just gorgeous. Like everywhere, the whole city is entirely gorgeous. And then the countryside, it just takes your breath away. So we did all the usual things. We did the Uffizi Museum, we did the Pitti Palace, the Boboli Gardens, we did the Basilica, the Duomo. And we did the Galileo Museum is there. I saw Galileo's telescope and Galileo's middle finger,
oh,
which is nice.
Oh, man.
That's
what,
very cool.
Middle finger?
His middle finger.
Yeah.
His middle finger's there for whatever reason.
It's like preserved, yeah.
And here's what we drove from Cinque Terre to Florence, and it was just a little bit of a side trip to go to Pisa, which, again, we didn't go to when we were there last time.
No, we didn't.
So we went to Pisa with low expectations. Right, because you know it's so cliche almost, right?
It's wicked touristy.
Yeah, but it was awesome. We were like, this is 100 times better than I thought it was going to be. Because it's not just the tower. There's a whole building there, and it was gorgeous.
There's other stuff there.
Yeah. It was impressive, and it's huge. And it looks like it's about to fall over. It really does when you're up there. It's like, this thing, why isn't this thing falling over right now? It's like, it looks like it's right on that edge. Of course, they stabilized it the way it is.
They've done a lot of stuff to it,
You can't go in it, right, Steve?
You can. You can go up to the top. We tried, but the...
What?
But it was like, oh, yeah, you could come back in 3 hours. We're like, no, we're just here for now. So,
I would never do that. I just, you know, as much as I know intellectually that it's not going to fall over, it's going to fall over.
you feel like it is. But it was gorgeous. I was like, wow, that was a nice little surprise. You know, we just did it on a lark. But it turned out to be a really worthwhile little side trip that we did.
All right, Steve, very important question to me. Which city did you like better, Rome or Florence?
I have to give it to Florence. I mean.
Really?
Yeah.
Rome?
That's what I'm talking about.
All right. So, Florence has David. Yeah, it's just hard.
Ponte Vecchio.
It has the Ponte Vecchio, which is adorable. You know, it has the Uffizi. Just, I think maybe the best single thing, I mean, it's hard to say even. I think, you know, in Rome, the best thing was the Palatine Hill, all the ruins, like the Forum, all of that was awesome. But, you know, seeing David is a transcendent experience.
But as far as the experience in each city, like, you know, Rome feels much more like a modern city, even though it has such unbelievable things there to see that are crazy old. But Florence is a walking city.
Yeah, you are transported in time when you're in Florence.
Yeah. It's different.
I mean, there are no cars allowed in the center of Florence. Like, it is literally just walking. Yeah. And so everybody is casually walking everywhere, and it's all about, it's just like the mood there is so wonderful. It's like, slowly take your time, you know, low stress. It's not noisy.
Mm-hmm.
And then there is so much to see and do. You are steeped in unbelievable, beautiful architecture. Like, every building looks like it comes from the other building. You know what I mean? They're all related to each other in a way that no other city really can pull off. Now, the one thing that Rome has over Florence, Steve, I don't know if you got into these details, but the bread in Florence is flavorless. I'm not kidding. I am not kidding when I tell you this, Kara. No. Like, it's made It's made, I believe, without any salt. Which
yeah, no, it's made.
Why?
So Panna Toscana, Tuscan bread, not just Florence, Tuscan bread is made without salt.
Okay.
And so when you eat it, it has no flavor. The crust is okay. The crust is good. The actual, the bready bread itself is like, you feel like you're eating paste. But that's that, you know, there's several theories as to why that is. You know, was it they were protesting a huge salt tax at the time, and then it got good to them, so they kept doing it or whatever. There's multiple reasons why it persisted. And now people from Tuscan, like that's bread to them. They like that. But here's the thing. They have very rich food. And so they say, well, we don't need flavor in the bread because you're always eating the bread with all of these salty sauces and other things. And in fact, they put that bread into their soups and into other things. And it doesn't get mushy. It doesn't get mushy. It gets spongy. So because of the lack of salt. So it makes sense. But I did note that in some of the restaurants, they would give us both Panna Toscana, like the Tuscan bread, and salted bread that was delicious. Mm. So sometimes we would get both, but not every time. And I had some, like the Tuscan tomato soup was off the hook, like just incredible. And that had, had the bread in it. You know, that's again like a Tuscan comfort food. You know, that's your grandmother's soup, you know?
But when it comes down to it, you know, the biting into a piece of Italian bread or French bread, you know, there is an experience with the flavor and the smell and everything. You know, so in Rome, the bread is utterly fantastic.
Yeah.
You know, as a standalone thing, right? You know, because Steve's right. Like, you're combining a lot of that bread with the food and everything. And the bread, like, everything else about it is perfect. It just doesn't have much flavor.
But also, there's extra virgin olive oil and balsamic vinegar on the table just there. Like, you don't have to ask for it. It's there. You're not going to ever, like, eat the bread without dunking it in, you know, olive oil and whatever else, you know, there is to dunk it in.
How much weight did you gain, Steve?
I don't think I gained any weight, to be honest with you, because
You walked.
Because, yeah, first of all, I was every day was a workout, like a massive. Yeah. I was burning so many calories. I mean, seriously. But also, like, we didn't eat like three big meals a day. We would just snack for breakfast. We would, if we did sit down for lunch, I had a salad, and then I just had my one pasta meal a night or meat dish, whatever, like my main deal. And the portion sizes are not huge. So I did not feel full
American
at the end
portions.
Of the meal. I was like, all right, this is good. This is like, if I eat this, I wasn't on a diet. No
you
way.
Weren't trying hard enough, man.
But I really don't think I gained any weight, because it was just like, I had it totally under control. Like, another thing is, the Italians obviously have obesity, but most of the people there, like compared to Americans, are thin, you know? Like, you wonder, how could they be eating this food every day and not be fat? Because part of it is that it's so good. It's satisfying. Like, you have a little bit of it. Like, that was just, I'm satisfied. That was so awesome. And rich.
Yeah, Americans eat, it's like, you know, we always talk about counting calories and like calorie control. So much of that is portion control.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So much of it
90%
is
portion control.
Yeah. Like, I remember one time going to a restaurant and there was this like woman who ordered and she said, okay, I want this and I want a box. And they were like, to go? And she was like, no, I just want a box right now. And they're like, okay. And she put, you know, 75% of it into the box. And she saw us looking at her when she did it. And she was like, I lost like 100 pounds by doing this.
Yeah.
I just want to sit down. Yeah. At a restaurant, I take 75% of my plate and I put it in the box. And then I eat it for three other meals.
So my advice to anybody who's going to travel to any of these cities is train, work out. Seriously, get in as good a shape as you can. You want to walk, you want to do stairs, because you know every place that you want to go, you are going to be climbing stairs, and you don't want to like not go to the Boboli Gardens or not go to the Duomo or not climb up to the top of the Palatine Hill because, you know, it's too much for you. So that's my advice. Obviously, this depends on a lot of particulars about the individual, but get in the best shape you can so that you could see the most, get the most out of the trip. You might not think about it. Like, it's too late when you're there.
Oh, yeah. Forget about it.
Yeah. Yeah, like my wife and I were working out over the summer to prepare for this trip because we knew what we were getting in for. I wouldn't have made it to the top of the Duomo if I hadn't been, you know, walking up and down the hills around my house, you know, at least 3 days a week for the last couple months.
Steve, what about Todoke, Steve? The red
I didn't find
juice.
It.
Holy crap. That's
did not find it.
All right, what about gelato?
That
it's
was
everywhere.
Like everywhere.
All right, just checking.
Gelato is awesome.
Steve, isn't the landscape in Tuscany just it looks like
storybook.
It's a slice of heaven.
It's
it is storybook.
Storybook.
It's amazing.
I love it. With the cypress trees and everything. You know, that's really interesting. I knew this, but, you know, I looked it up again just to confirm. Rome is north of New York City in terms of latitude.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
Right? You think, and like Europe's in Canada.
Yeah, all of Europe is pretty much
They just have, like, there's a climate thing going on where they get the warm air off the water or whatever, but it's like, it's like subtropical there. And like, wow, we're like, we're north of New York City here. It was hot. It was hot when we were there.
Well, yeah. I mean, their summers are crazy hot.
Yeah. But wonderful trip. Wonderful trip. We started talking about where we're going to go next. We do have to. I think our next big trip, though, has to be the going to Texas for the solar eclipse. Right?
Yeah. We have to do that, you guys. We can, like, stay. My parents are there. And, like, that's, you know, I grew up there and stuff. So I can really kind of help.
Can we sleep in your old room?
No, we don't have the house. I don't have my old room anymore. My parents have, like, a different house. But we can, you know, we can see my old stomping grounds.
You sure you guys want to bring me?
No, Bob, we're sending you to Buffalo.
Buffalo. I would not blame you.
And we are going to Texas.
Would not blame you. I will pay people. People, if you don't want me to go to Buffalo, pay me some money and I won't go.
Pay to keep Bob away. That's so sad.
It took me a minute to figure out what you were getting at, Bob. And then I'm like, oh yeah, Bob has the ability to obfuscate anything happening in the sky.
Yes, I will ruin your viewing pleasure.
Yeah. No, we don't really believe that Bob controls the weather. It's just confirmation bias. But we have had a string of bad luck.
But God, Bob, I've been rolling a string of ones, my friend. Yeah.
Imagine if we go to Texas and it is cloudy. I mean, that'll cement this thing into eternity.
Into myth for eons. Oh, yeah.
All right. Well, before we get to the news item, actually, we're starting with a news item that we discuss in our upcoming book, The Skeptic's Guide to the Future. So we want to update everybody on the book. So we have two promotional thingamajigs happening with the book. One is an exclusive offer for SGU listeners. So if you're listening to this podcast, you can go to the link that we will provide on our book website. So you go to, you know, the skepticsguide.org, you click on our books. There will be a link there. There already is a link there that says pre-order the book, you know, for The Skeptic's Guide to the Future. And that takes you to the publisher's website. Now, we do that because we have control over our website. We don't have control over the publisher's website, and we want to make sure we always can give you all the information you need in a timely fashion. And it's just one more click through to the publisher. We'll explain what you're going to find there. So the publishers will it's not there right now as you're recording this, but I think by the time this show goes up, they will have a link on their site. You can, if you have pre-ordered the book in any format, you can submit your pre-order information, like your receipt information, and you can get an exclusive sticker decal that you could put on your laptop or your computer or your backpack or wherever you want.
I want one.
Number two is, just like with the first book, we will be signing a bunch of book plates. There's a couple of different retailers who are doing a signed book deal. It'll be a limited number. Like, obviously, we can only sign a finite number of book plates. And then those links will be there as well. So again, that link isn't there right now, but that, as we're recording this, it may be there by the time you're listening to this, but just check back if it's not there. Just go through our website. We'll keep you updated on our website, where you can order through a couple of different retailers pre-signed books. So if you don't anticipate that you'll be seeing us in person sometime soon, you can get a pre-signed book. If you do anticipate you'll be seeing us at any of our, you know, live events, we always do book signings when we're there. So.
Now, there's another little secret that I want to drop, Steve.
Go ahead, Jay.
In chapter 23, now we've never said this before, but in chapter 23, about midway through the chapter, Steve gets naked in the chapter.
Mm-hmm. What?
I got naked while I was writing it and while I was recording the audio.
But there had to be in really character. Tell. There is nudity in this book. Just keep this in mind. Steve is naked while he was writing it. You have to think about that when you're reading chapter 23. That's all I'm going to say. I don't want to drop too many more secrets this early on.
Now, one of the things that we touch upon in the book on the future of energy is, will we have space-based solar power in the future? Is that going to be a thing? And now, Jay, you're going to start us off on the news items because the European Space Agency is actually considering it. Tell us what they're doing.
Yeah, there's a lot of things to tell you guys about this. I know and I'm sure all of us are going to have a lot to say after I get through the meat of this one. All right, so let's start with the basics. there is an incredible amount of energy radiating from the sun. I think I said this a few episodes ago. Like, you know, imagine if we could collect, you know, more solar radiation, you know, than just what hits the Earth. Think of all of that solar radiation coming off, and a very, very, very small portion of that solar radiation enters the Earth's atmosphere and makes its way all the way down to the surface of the Earth. And that's where, you know, today's modern solar panels, that's where we're collecting solar energy. And we're doing a remarkable job so far, right? We're doing massive increases in efficiency. And, you know, when we transfer the energy from one form to another, we're getting better and better at, you know, retaining as much energy as possible. But, you know, there is a clearer shot to sunlight, and that would be in outer space, right? Because there's no atmosphere. There's 6 miles or 10,000 kilometers of atmosphere to go through. So that atmosphere does obscure quite a bit of that energy and makes it a little bit more difficult to collect. So imagine collecting solar energy without any atmosphere in the way. So space-based solar collection, if it were in outer space, would be able to collect solar radiation 24 hours a day because, as you know, most places on Earth, there's a nighttime, and at night you can't collect solar radiation. So anyway, that would be another perk for that. The European Space Agency, also known as the ESA, is actively considering to increase their energy independence, especially, you know, with things like what's going on in Ukraine with the war and, you know, realizing that they're relying on other countries or other areas of the world to get energy from. They want to be independent. They want to be able to produce as much of their own energy as possible. They also want to decrease their greenhouse gas emissions, which is great. So the ESA has decided that they were going to hire researchers to estimate the cost and benefits of space-based solar collection. The director of the ESA, Josef Achbacher, is presenting his plan for space-based solar collection, and it's going to be called the Solaris Program, and he's going to present it to the ESA in November. Now, it's estimated that the satellites could collect as much as one-third of the annual 3,000 terawatt-hours used in Europe, right? So that's a lot of energy. And they're saying that this solar array that they could potentially put up in outer space could collect a third of the annual energy usage, which is a lot. That's a lot of energy. Now, the idea to put solar collection satellites into orbit is something that we've seen in science fiction, right? I mean, I've seen tons and tons of pictures throughout my life of like, you know, some type of thing in outer space collecting energy or redirecting energy or shooting energy beams from like the moon to the Earth and that type of thing. The satellites that they're proposing would convert solar radiation into current and then beam down the collected energy in the form of microwaves. And those microwaves could be received by a photovoltaic cell or antennas, where then it would be converted again back into electricity. The satellites would be put into a geostationary orbit around 36,000 kilometers from Earth. There would be dozens of these satellites. They would be very big, each one approximately 10 times the mass of the International Space Station. So I don't know if you could visualize how big that is. That's big. That's big. The current space station, the ISS today, is about 450 metric tons. And just so you understand, it took a very long time. It took 10 years to construct that space station in low Earth orbit. In order to fully deploy the array of solar collecting satellites that they're proposing in this idea, it's estimated that they would need, now get this, guys, hundreds to thousands of heavy lift launches to push all of that hardware into low Earth orbit, right? Just put a little checkbox next to what I said there. That's point.
Thousands of launches?
Yes. Now let's talk about that, Kara. The number of launches would be so big that Europe may have to develop its own heavy lift rocket in order to accommodate the need here and how frequently they would have to do it. Now, so with current and near future launch capability. So as an example, right? What do we got? We got SpaceX as a commercial company. NASA has heavy lift rockets. You know, other countries have heavy lift rockets. So what they did was they said, well, how often would we be able to schedule our hardware to be launched by, you know, what will it look like in the next 20 plus years? Would we be able to hire enough launches to get it done? And the answer was no. And they were saying that it would take 4 to 6 years to deploy just one of these dozens of satellites that they need to deploy, right? Because if it took
to get a third of their energy.
Yeah. Now let's keep going here. The entire endeavor would cost hundreds of billions of euros. That's a lot of money. That's an incredible amount of money. I'm not saying that we shouldn't spend hundreds of billions of euros on space. I'm just saying for this particular thing, I think that's a lot of money. It almost seems out of reach and maybe not the best way to solve the problem that they're trying to solve, which is to become mostly independent and they want it to be green. So a few years ago, Elon Musk actually made it clear he thinks that this whole thing is a bad idea. He said that the collected energy would need to be converted twice as many times as solar collected on Earth, right? This would, you know, every time you convert the energy, you lower the overall output because you lose energy during the conversion process. So he's saying like, okay, so let's say that these solar arrays can collect double amount of solar radiation. Well, you're going to lose about 50% of your energy just by the conversion process. So there's lots of technologies that are not there yet that would have to be there in order for this thing to make sense in any way, right? It has also been estimated that if they're collecting solar radiation in outer space, that it would be three orders of magnitude more expensive than Earth-based solar collection. Three orders of magnitude.
1,000 times.
Mm-hmm. That's crazy. That's right there. So as per the new program, they could start development. If it gets approved, they could start this whole project in, as early as 2025. Wow, that's not too far from that. If you think about it, it's only a few years, you know, not that far to go. So the ESA's Project Solaris will spend an initial investment to study the feasibility of all of this, right? So here's the part that brings things back into reality. They decided we need to invest some money so we could check our math. Let's make sure that everything we're talking about is legit. So they want to answer questions like, how would this be actually implemented? Are there environmental health or safety issues that would be involved? Are there regulatory issues or international space policy considerations? How about this? Is the technology even possible in this time frame? Mm-hmm. And when we say the technology, we're talking about lots of technology. You know, even like them having to build their own heavy lift rocket, like, is that feasible? Would they even be able to get something on its feet soon enough to make have an impact on this project? Now, I would imagine that this project would require an incredible amount of work to be done in space itself, right? You know, I think about the amount of hardware that they're putting up in space, you know, 10 times the size of the ISS. Well, there happens to be a lot of man hours, like real people have to be in space using their hands, using power tools to put stuff together like this. Now, I don't know. Is it possible that they'd come up with drone robots or, you know, like, to do this work? I have no idea. They'd have to on
also
some level.
Also to maintain them. Here's the other thing you didn't mention, Jay. I don't think you mentioned it. The life expectancy of solar panels right now, the industry standard is 25 to 30 years, but it's anticipated that a orbital solar panel would have a much shorter life expectancy. First, it's getting sun 24/7. So right there, it's going to be like half. But also that, you know, space is not a very friendly environment. You think, oh, there's no weather, there's no moisture, but it's just not a friendly environment. There's radiation, again, the solar wind, et cetera. So what if the life expectancy is like 15 years?
It wouldn't be, it really starts to get crazy when you think about all those factors. Now, I had an idea. This is like a nightmare situation, right? So let's say they get half of these satellites up, and they've spent $50 billion already to get, you know, doing this, right? And then the first fusion reactor comes online, and they're like,
what a nightmare.
No. What I mean is they've invested all of this time and energy, and now we have a working positive energy flow fusion reactor that, you know, at that point would need just to be rolled out and reproduced.
Or just really good next gen fission reactors.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Exactly.
Or just next gen geothermal. Like, the real limiting factor with geothermal is the locations. But if you could cheaply drill deeper, suddenly there's way more locations where you could put geothermal. So anyway, I think this is probably the last thing they should be dumping billions of dollars in order to fight climate change, you know, in order to get clean energy. The technology is not there yet. We'll think about it in next century.
I mean, all you need
for now.
All you need is an afternoon of Googling to figure out that this is not, we're not ready for prime time.
It's yeah. just way too early, you know, to be considering this. I think we can have a future where this play, where we can have, you know, solar based, you know, space based solar collecting, even on the moon. Even the moon has benefits to things in orbit. But there's so many things to consider. Any one of them or two of them would be just a deal killer by themselves. Like, how about the receiving station on the ground? They would be gargantuan, and yep. one of them would be like $1 billion just for one receiving station. Oh man, yeah, yeah. Let's robotically maintain them in orbit. Yeah, we've done that before. Yeah, we've had robots working yeah. in space like that. And you can't have people doing it because of the high radiation dangers in you know, in geosynchronous orbit. It's not good. High risk, high radiation dangers. It's just way. I can't believe they're considering this for more than an afternoon. It's like it's not ready. No time. Well, it's not the
do
time
a
to
feasibility
do it.
Study. Sure, do it. But I mean, I would not sink serious money into this. I think it should be pretty cheap to figure out that this is not ready, as you say, for prime time. This is a next century kind of thing to think about.
Yeah, and I mean, I could
get
that
way
all.
Cheaper to get into space. We got to have much better solar technology. We have to have robotic, you know, remote technology that, you know, that can keep maintain things. It's just not ready. And again, by the time this becomes feasible, we might have fusion, as you say.
Yeah, you have to exhaust all the terrestrial-based solutions first. You know, before you start strapping metal to rockets and trying to push it into orbit and get into that whole fiasco, right? Because it's a whole other thing. You know, exhaust every single land-based option that you have first. And we're not even close to there yet. I mean, what about putting it on the ocean? You know, like, you know,
rooftop, low hanging fruit. Use this money to put solar panels on every rooftop of every building, right? Do that first. That's a lot. That's more energy. That's a third of our energy right there. That's more than this.
Yeah, but then
thousandths of the cost.
Yeah, but Steve, then even when you got to maintain it, you got to go all the way up to the roof, and there might not be an elevator at the top. You got to take stairs. Like, oh,
there's insects. I mean, come on, Steve. Well, I you know, I'm torn here because I love the space enthusiasm.
It's a sexy idea, but it is a siren. It's a technological siren song. It is not something that we should be sinking a lot of money into. It's not as dumb as solar roads, but you know, it's pretty much in the same category. Yeah.
Oh my God, Steve, that's such a diss. Solar roads, really? Like if you're compared to solar roads, you know you've hit rock bottom.
Yeah. It's just not practical. Like it looks good on paper, but it's not practical. That's what I mean. All right. Let's move on. You could read more about that in our book. As I said.
Steve, where can they what's happening with this? What do you mean? Yeah, read?
Go
what
to skepticsguide.org, click on our books, and there you will see a link to pre-order The Skeptic's Guide to the Future. There you go.
Thank you.
Okay. This is a really interesting paper. This is about the underlying theory of how people make decisions. Carrie, you're going to be really interested in this.
Okay.
Okay. The question,
yeah, so it's a provocative article. It's a provocative article. The title of the article is "We Don't Have 100 Biases, We Have the Wrong Model" by Jason Collins, who is a behavioral economist. So, you know, economists also study human decision making, right? Buying and selling and all that stuff. There's a lot of overlap with social psychology, behavioral psychology, and neuroscience in general. Here's the analogy he starts with. In the back in the day when we had a geocentric model of the universe, right? We thought the Earth is at the center of the universe and everything went around the Earth. And that model predicted how everything should be moving in the sky. But of course, like the planets and the sun and everything, didn't move the way the model predicted. So they had to make exceptions. They had to make tweaks, add epicycles.
Epicycles.
And add all these tweaks in order to make the data fit the model. But at the end of the day, that was replaced by the heliocentric model, and then Kepler's three laws of planetary motion, et cetera. So now you have an elegant, simple model where you don't have to make a lot of exceptions.
That explains most of our observations.
Yeah. There were a few tweaks with like Mercury, et cetera. But then we needed relativity, Einstein. Same thing. You know, now, but with relativity, we don't need any more tweaks, at least when looking at like how stuff is moving in the sky, right? Okay, so he said, what if we're in the geocentric phase of scientific research trying to understand how people make decisions, why people make the decisions they do. And right now, this is sort of an overly simplistic explanation of the current state of the science, but this is basically what's going on. The behavioral economists, their core theory, their core model of human behavior, of human decision making, is the rational actor model. People make rational decisions in their own self-interest if they have enough bandwidth, right? Enough cognitive processing power to get to the optimal answer, and they have the willpower to execute it, right? So, but people are basically rational actors. Now, we know that that's not true because, behaviorists study all of the exceptions to that, and they call those deviations from the predictions of the rational actor model biases or heuristics, right? Mm-hmm. And so, but that's what he means by maybe there aren't hundreds of biases.
Right. Maybe
the rational actor model is just wrong, and we need a better model that won't require all of these tweaks to explain how people actually behave. Okay, I'm with him so far. I get, right, guys, with that, you get understand the basic concept.
Basically. But I also don't see like biases as exceptions to the rule. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like
we're on the same page, Gary.
Yeah. Oh, okay. All right.
So he also we'll get there. He also very fascinating. I love it. It's a meta question. I love meta questions because it's like forces you to step back and think on a deeper level. And then he goes on to say, it's like, and there are other models, like the rational actor model isn't the only one. There's also like cognitive dissonance model that says we make decisions based on minimizing our cognitive dissonance, which is a disconnect between different beliefs that we hold at the same time, right? Mm-hmm. Most of those are partial or conditional or situational, and they're kind of tweaks to the rational actor model too. And so that doesn't solve the problem for us. So now Collins doesn't say, here's the new model I think we should go with. He's just saying, we need to find a new model, right? He doesn't say what it is.
Oh, okay.
And then he talks about, like, how might we get there? And he says, well, we can, you know, maybe learn some things from artificial intelligence, like AI algorithms have behavior to optimize outcomes, you know? And so that's kind of like what people do. And so we could study how AIs make decisions, and maybe that will provide us some insight. He talks about evolutionary psychology, like, you know, which is a thing unto itself. And I know it's very problematic, but he said that mm-hmm. might provide us some information about why we do what we do. And he said, but this is what we need to do. We need to find a way to figure out a better model. You know, here's a money quote. This is where he lost me. I'm going to just quote a paragraph that he says. But the proliferation of models is a problem parallel to the accumulation of biases. A proliferation of models with slight tweaks to the rational actor model shows the flexibility and power of that model, but also its major flaw. Economics journals are full of models of decision-making designed to capture a particular phenomenon, but rarely are these models systematically tested, rejected, or improved, or ultimately integrated into a common theoretical framework. And if you can find a model to explain everything, again, you explain nothing. So, okay, I partly agree with him there that, yes, we do need to question our models. We do need to say, could there be a more elegant, you know, approach to this rather than just, you know, slapping on exceptions and biases and more tweaks of other specific models. And I also agree that, you know, he talks about the fact that this kind of research has a massive replication problem, and maybe there's a reason for that, because we're not really testing, we're not linking all these things together to some underlying theoretical framework. We're missing a comprehensive theoretical framework. So he did not convince me, and here's why. Carrie, you can tell me. I'm interested to hear what you think about this. So the thing is, he didn't really mention what I always thought the answer was to all of this. He didn't mention two things, which basically are at the core of my thinking about this topic. So we talk about on the show all the time, almost every time a neuroscience, like psychological study comes up, we ask, are we at bedrock here? Or are we just looking at downstream effects? Like, is this fundamentally how the human brain functions? Or is this just a marker of what's really happening, you know, underneath? You know, we talk about like the marshmallow test wasn't, you know, in, at least not in every case, wasn't looking at what was really happening. So yes, we have to question that. But what if, here's my big what if the underlying theoretical framework is that there is no elegant theory of human decision making.
That's like what I was thinking the whole time. Like, why does there have to be a grand unified theory of decision making?
So my
heuristic
model is that like human decision making is a committee. You have you know, all these different circuits screaming at the same time, and one group of them sort of align in a direction and are a little bit louder than all the others, and that's the decision you make, right? And it's chaos, like it's trying to predict the weather.
And it's also so influenced by not just your it's so influenced by socialization and by how you're raised that one model probably doesn't apply to a whole group of people.
Right, which is why they're usually these studies are like really on the margins. Like, oh, we 5% more people did this than that or whatever.
Yeah.
Sometimes there's more robust effects, but often they're looking at very marginal effects. So he didn't convince me that there isn't that decision making isn't a kludge, and that the underlying theory is not that there is no underlying unifying theory. And then also here's the other thing, and I wonder if this is a bias in behaviorists, is he didn't, when he was talking about the things that might lead us to a more elegant, more integrated theoretical framework, he didn't mention neuroscience.
At all?
He didn't mention, the one thing that I think will most inform this question, which is looking at functional connective networks in the brain. That's the bedrock. When we say there's a circuit that does this, now, it's going to be contextual. It's going to depend on what other circuits are doing. But that's the closest that we're going to get to behavioral, cognitive bedrock, is identifying specific circuits that do something that we can understand what they're doing. That's like one person on the committee is that functional circuit. And he didn't really talk about that.
Yeah, without understanding the neuroscience, none of it is anything, because it all comes – it's like – I remember taking history and systems of psychology course, and this is a very common course that psychologists take, psychology students. For whatever reason, a lot of other disciplines don't require history and systems courses, which to me is bananas, because it's like, how do we know what we know? It's very important to study that. So anyway, I remember we were discussing all of the different kind of theories of psychology, all of the different groups of people who, and this is very clear with clinical psychology, right? You can talk about the psychoanalysts, and you can talk about the behaviorists, and you can talk about the whatever. But that kind of follows in research as well. And I remember my professor posing to the class, will we ever be able to unify all of these different views of psychology into one grand theory? And there was, big argumentation. Oh, I think the behaviorists will win out because it'll be that with a little bit of this, or no, definitely the analysts, or definitely the developmental psychologists. And my answer to the question in the class was, if there ever were any unifying theory, it would be neuropsychology.
Yes.
Like, it may still not answer everything, but it's the only thing that even has the potential to answer, because all of these other things are, as you mentioned, they are the emergent properties of what's happening in the brain.
The bedrock is the circuits.
Yes, it has to be.
I totally believe that.
Yeah, and we may never be able to read the code and know what the actual function is, right? That may be something that's out of our grasp.
I do think that artificial intelligence research, basically crisscrossing AI research with neuroscience, neuroanatomical correlates of behavior, will get us the closest that we can get to it.
Yeah, I think,
when we can test it systematically, when we could say, okay, what happens if we turn this circuit down or remove this circuit or add this circuit, then how does that influence it? And then we could make analogies to how the human brain's working, and then we could model the human brain in silicon. I don't know when we're going to get there, but that, when in my opinion, we will get to this grand unified theory when we're doing that, when we are actually figuring out circuit, functional circuit to functional circuit, like what is happening in the brain. We're not going to do it by just studying what people do.
No, and this is why cognitive psychology has always confused me as a discipline, because when you take a cognitive or like a sensory and perception course, a cog psych course, a big part of what they talk about is, let's say we're talking about memory. There are all these concepts that you have to know, like, the phonological loop and the sketch pad and the whatever, and you're learning all of these, but they're constructs that never are describing the fundamental correlates. And I'm always so confused in these classes, because I'm like, This is just someone's model. It's almost like language and then the thing that the language describes. Like once we, you know, we know it's symbolic interactionism, and we know that the deeper we get into language, the more meaning we have around the concepts that the language itself describes. But the language is not the table. The word table also, is not the table.
I would make a different analogy. It's okay. Like trying to understand the speech centers of the brain by studying language.
Oh, yeah, for
You'll
sure.
You'll never figure out the speech centers of the brain. Like, you won't figure out there's an arcuate fasciculus that connects the Wernicke's area to Broca's area. Like, you won't figure that out by studying language. You have to look at the brain. And once you do know, when you combine those two things...
And that's the important part, is the combining, because you'll never really understand the beauty of speech if you just study the brain.
Right. It's just meat if you're just looking at the brain. You got to look at both. You know, it is, you could say, oh, there's circuits are firing, but you don't know what they're doing until you connect it to behavior. You need both. That is the critical thing. So I think that was a big hole in his argument. And he didn't convince me that, again, that biases are tweaks to a wrong model. I think biases are real phenomenon representing algorithms that are actually in our brain. At least some of them are, and maybe some are maybe not, again, not at what I call bedrock. They're not fundamental. They may be manifestations of more fundamental things that are happening, like different contextual manifestations of more fundamental things. And, you know, I do think we are figuring some of that stuff out. Like, you know, people fundamentally want to be loved and, you know, want to feel secure and whatever, all these things, you know, those are sort of fundamental. And that could manifest in 100 ways, you know, but we don't call every 100 things its own thing necessarily. You know, sometimes we do because what they're describing is what we can see in research, right? That's, as we say all the time,
this
is a construct, like, because we're looking where the light is good. We're studying what we can measure in research.
In university undergrads in a psychology course.
Right. It's not necessarily what's actually happening in the brain. But fascinating thought process here, you know, just try to this. We talk about this all the time, and this was like right on the money in terms of this meta question about what is the model of behavior, you know.
And don't you think it speaks to this bigger question that is, and I'm so fascinated by this question philosophically, Lulu Miller writes about it beautifully in Why Fish Don't Exist, this idea of the human need to like categorize and to model and to say, no, I figured out how to bucket all of these things so that they make sense. And this obsession with like, oh, but now that's an exception. Just like you said at the very beginning, what if the model is that there is no model? Like, why do we need to model everything?
That's a circuit that makes us want to do that. That's one of our biases. That's how we grapple with, you know. So here's
– it's again, in the past.
This is a concept that I think is very legitimate, and that is that our brains are not powerful enough to grapple with reality. Mm-hmm. And so – we have tons of algorithms whose basic purpose is to get close enough to reality.
Mm-hmm. With we're least, all about the heuristics.
With the least
shortcuts.
Amount of processing power. So it's like efficiently getting an approximation that's good enough. That's how our brain
good enough to spread our seed.
Those are heuristics.
If you're at work, if you're at work and you screw something up, you just tell your boss, I mean, it's good enough. I did a good enough job, right? I mean, because you clearly can't blame any one of us for screwing things up because our brain is not perceiving reality. Is that what you're saying?
No, because that's why we have external systems in place like checklists and checking things over multiple times and multiple people checking over mission critical things.
Because, and performance reviews.
Rather than relying on brute cognitive power, we rely upon external systems that minimize error. Error minimization is a thing. That is a total discipline unto itself, and it is critical when you're flying a plane or doing surgery or practicing medicine or whatever. So then this comes down to, you've opened a can of worms with that question. I'm just going to give a very quick answer. This comes down to how we combine the heuristic approach, right, with the analytical approach. Mm-hmm. So first, like, you get the first blush of, oh, this feels like this to me, right?
Validity.
But I have to back up and go through analytically and say, if I do the math and look it up and go systematically through all the things, do I get to the same answer? Am I missing something or whatever?
Sounds like science to me.
You've got to back
it
up with analysis.
When you talk to like astrophysicists, like actual experimental or even theoretical physicists, I feel like they do the same thing when they do their mental math. I have so many friends who work in physics who will be able to rattle off large numbers really readily, but they're not calculating to the you know, single digit. They're just able to go, eh, it's roughly, you know, however many light years. It's roughly 500 million of this because they're doing order of magnitude math.
Right. We call it a back of the envelope calculation. Yeah, right. It's an estimate that's close enough to think about plausibility or whatever. Like,
because when you're working with sufficiently big enough numbers, it doesn't really matter if you're off by a million or whatever. And then they're able to do the real calculations and go, oh, okay, this that has exactly 17 more zeros. We did something wrong.
Yeah, but like knowing that space-based solar panels cost 1,000 times as much as ground-based space panels is enough. We don't need to know that 5 decimal points places how much more expensive that order of magnitude estimate is enough. And that's a good skill to have.
Sort of a good parallel between like the heuristics that we use to figure out good enough versus the science that we use to get it down to the, you know, third decimal place.
Exactly.
Right.
But we do have to remember also that we, you know, evolved in a much simpler environment, and now we're trying to use those heuristics that we learned, you know, in the wild, in a complicated technological civilization with, you know, thousands of years of culture and history and everything behind it, and systems, you know, like legal systems and you know, economic systems, et cetera. So our evolved biases and heuristics are evolved estimates that minimize our cognitive energy to get to a good enough answer is not good enough anymore.
Yeah, and they
can that's
be
why
hurtful.
We need institutions and systems and math and philosophy and, you know, we need all these things.
The big artificial intelligence.
The takeaway is we're big fat kludges.
Yeah, totally.
Well, not only is it not good enough, right, to get to the answer, but it also sometimes backfires, and that I think that's a big important part of not just the skeptical movement and what we you know are part of doing here, but also the work that, like, for example, that I do in therapy is helping people understand, like, why do I feel this way if I thought I was making a good decision, or, you know, why am I feeling conflicted here? It's like, well, of course, because we didn't evolve in modern society.
Nope.
Like, you see this a lot with conversations about, like, the 40-hour work week and the whatever. It's like, human beings didn't evolve to sit at a desk for 40 hours. Yeah. Like, that was never a part of the plan evolutionarily. And these kinds of things can be in conflict. And I think understanding that about ourselves, cutting ourselves slack when we utilize our heuristics, understanding their shortcomings, having that metacognition, as we always talk about, the neuropsychological humility, but also being able to go, and that's okay, because I am a human being.
Right. And also, it's humility, and it's also compassion. And
yes.
It's very challenging in, like, the current political environment. It's really hard not to be judgmental, even really angry at people who believe things that feel so wrong to you. And it's easy to moralize and be judgmental, but you have to understand they're just following their algorithms the same way you are. They just have different inputs and outputs than you do. You know what I mean? All right, let's move on. All right, Kara, tell us about growing crops in cities.
Right. So, you know, we often think about urban farming. That's a term that's often used. What do you see when you imagine urban farming?
Rooftops.
Yeah, that's a big one.
Windowsill.
Right.
Limited scale.
Okay.
Now hydroponics.
Yield.
You know.
Exactly. So, like, there's the green spaces within urban environment, so community gardens, or even there's a guy in LA, he calls himself Ron Finley, he calls himself the Renegade Gardener, and he plants, you know, that little strip of green, and I'm saying it this way because I did the New York Times use guys thing, and everybody calls it something different depending on where in the country you live, but that strip of green between the sidewalk and the street.
Yeah.
That little thing, he like plants it. Technically, that's city property, but he plants like edible vegetables on those all the time so that people can start having little gardens out in their front yards. It's really brilliant. Anyway, so those are green belts or green spaces, but there's also what's called gray spaces. So these are places where there is no soil, but we can still grow hydroponic crops. So tower gardens, for example, which you can do indoors in your house or on your patio or on the roof of your apartment building. So there are, you know, different approaches to urban farming. Basically, we often think of urban farming as a sort of niche thing, like almost a cute thing that, you know, and I have a robot garden. It goes in my kitchen, you plug it in, it's self-watering, it's self-lighting, it has all these great features, but it takes me a while to grow basically one salad's worth of lettuce because it's just not terribly efficient. But, you know, I get the hang of it. I have a lot of friends, though, who can feed themselves with the way that they grow food in their urban apartments here in Los Angeles. So the question here is urban farming efficient enough to feed the residents? Are the yields high enough, or do we really still need to rely on what we think of as conventional agriculture or rural approaches to farming? And there have been a lot of different studies asking very specific questions, but there's a really big study that just was released where the team actually did basically a meta-analysis. So they looked at studies from 53 different countries. And they said, you know, which crops grow well in cities? How are they growing the crops? Like, what is the most effective way to grow them? And where are they being grown? And we want to know, does it measure up to conventional farming? And what do you guys think?
Probably did surprisingly well.
Surprisingly well. Yeah. No, it did as well, if not better in several instances than conventional rural farming, and sometimes 3 to 4 times the efficiency. Yeah.
Why is that?
So certain crops, especially like watery fruits and vegetables, so think about like cucumbers, think about tomatoes, also things like lettuces, they grow crazy well hydroponically. Mm-hmm. And when you think about a hydroponic system, and I have seen, and we may have talked about this on the show before, these shipping container farms that are completely sealed to be airtight, and they're basically tractor trailers, so you can drive them to different regions that are 100% no loss farms. So basically the water, if it does become water vapor, it recondenses. It doesn't evaporate the way that water evaporates when you're planting in a field, you know, because it's not going into the Earth's water cycle. It's going into its own closed water cycle. Also, the all of the different fertilizers and all of the different basically components that go into the farming can be measured to the, you know, microgram. And so the science of growing crops in a really controlled environment can really help with efficiency. The question has always been, you know, does it cost more to do it? Is it worthwhile to do it this way? And the authors of this paper do caveat and say the cost thing is still a very open question, right? Is growing conventionally, although let's be honest, conventional farming is not cheap. It may be we think of as more pastoral, more idyllic. It may be something that, you know, the skills have been handed down generation to generation. But farmers still have a lot of expenses. And a lot of conventional farms are barely breaking even. A lot of conventional farms have to work really, really hard to turn a profit. And the profit is really at the whims of the weather. It's at the whims of the climate and the environment. And of course, we know that this is ever changing and its whims are becoming less and less predictable. So when you're in a more closed urban environment, there's a way to actually mitigate against a lot of those issues. But even green spaces, like you guys mentioned, roof farms, small community farms, even within places where there is sort of the capriciousness of the weather and of the climate are important to consider. They are surprisingly efficient if you choose the right crops, right? You're not going to grow wheat that way.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, but you're going to be able to probably grow lettuce.
Yeah, really, leafy and vegetables are good.
Yeah, leafy greens, vegetables grow super well hydroponically, but they also grow well in a really planned small farm where you can rotate. And so basically the big takeaway from this study, and again, remember, 53 different countries, a ton of different studies, because this was a meta-analysis, that across the board, most rural settings, crops grew as well, if not better, and sometimes up to 3 and 4 times as well as in conventional agriculture. They also surprisingly found that there weren't a lot of differences between indoor and outdoor green urban growing. So it could be that we're not as efficient as we need to be with the indoor closed spaces. It could be that a lot of people who are doing these community gardens are really being innovative and learning how to grow the right things for their right climates. Regardless, what we are finding is that there's just not that much data. This study is a good first step because what these researchers, and it's almost kind of like activist research. They're basically saying these questions need to be answered from a policy perspective, because when we go to local governments and we say we need to invest infrastructure, we need to be putting our money into these urban farm initiatives, they're saying, why? Show me that it's going to be worthwhile. Show me the ROI. And the data just hasn't really been there, because it's been really like piecemeal and mismatched, and like the variables haven't been controlled. And so this large meta-analysis is showing us that, for example, you know, only 5 to 10% of like legumes, vegetables, tubers are grown in urban settings. 15 to 20% globally overall of food is produced in cities. But does it need to be that way? Could we up those yields significantly and actually save money in the process? And this study is showing that maybe it looks like, you know, at least from what we see so far, urban farming is as efficient, if not more efficient, and it could become even more efficient with more more investment in technology. Yeah, more R&D.
Totally. Yeah, it's all about growing the optimal crop for this location and the situation that you're in. That's like a huge part of maximizing efficiency.
Which you don't have to do if you have a closed system, because you can mimic almost any environment with lighting, with humidity, with concentrations of different, you know, nitrogen concentrations, different soil concentrations. It's pretty incredible what you can do in basically a crop lab. I mean, think about it. Almost any ag university is growing every crop in a lab right now.
No, I mean, I was talking to Kevin Folto about this when I was trying to get, you know, something to fruit. And he's like, here, get a bulb, like an infrared bulb with this very specific frequency. And that will induce fruiting. Like they have it dialed in. I think we talked not too long ago about hydroponics. I mean, remember hydroponics, first of all, it's vertical. It uses very little water compared to, you know, land-based. And there's no pests, no pesticide, no loss due to pests, no resistance to pesticides, none of that.
And with no soil, you're not having to, first of all, harvest soil or grow soil. You're not having to deplete the nitrogen that's in the soil.
No fertilizer.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, it's better for the environment. It's better. And again, it doesn't work for every crop, but for the crops that we can grow that way, we can do it in a small space, highly efficient, fewer ingredients going into the farming equation, and less basically pollution coming out of it.
And you're growing the food where it's going to be eaten, so you don't have to truck it across the country. You know, it's you're growing it in the city where you're going to sell it.
Yeah, you're growing it basically in situ, which is so smart.
All right, thanks, Kara.
Yep.
Bob, tell us about protons having charm.
Those charming protons.
Yes, protons were in the news, and researchers claim the evidence that could change physics textbooks. If they're correct, basically, they say that everyday protons may fundamentally be composed of not just the usual suspects, but also the heavy charm quarks as well. And if true, that this would mean protons could at times contain elements that counterintuitively weigh more than the entire proton itself.
What?
Hello, quantum mechanics. So yes, this fascinating study was published in the August 18th edition of Nature, by the NNPDF collaboration. That stands for the Neural Network Parton Distribution Function Collaboration. Okay, so if you haven't noticed, I love quarks, and I'm going to talk about them. They are in many ways the most important particles in the universe, actually. They come in six so-called flavors: up, down, strange, charm, bottom, and top. We've all heard these before. Two of the six are especially important, the up and down, especially important. They compose all the protons and neutrons in atoms that we see everywhere in our normal lives. Look around right now. You're seeing a whole mess of up and down quarks. Now, if Thanos snapped his fingers and peered inside a proton, he'd see two up quarks and one down quark. The protons and neutrons are bound together by the strongest force in nature, called, unimaginatively, of course, the strong force. But that force, though, for all intents and purposes, can be said to derive from the bizarre, even more bizarre and amazing color force that's binding the quarks that are inside those protons and neutrons. And that color force arises because the quarks are constantly exchanging another type of particle. This is a force carrier called gluons. Now, gluons in this context, you can think of them as analogous to photons that make up light, right? The electromagnetic force between two charged particles. The gluon is just the color force between between two quarks. Okay, so now this concept of a proton that's composed of three quarks exchanging gluons is the top of the proverbial onion layer that I talk about. So this for this news item, we're going to need to go just a layer or two deeper, and I promise not to make you cry a little bit. So
okay.
Inside a proton, gluons can at times split. Did you know that? Creating vast quantities of quark-antiquark pairs. Now, these are transient quarks and can include the other more massive quarks. It doesn't have to be just the up and down. These could be the strange or the bottom quark as well, showing up in these quark-antiquark pairs within the proton. So now these have actually been identified in the debris when protons smash together at near the speed of light in colliders like the Large Hadron Collider. Now these pairs are thought to be the result of the kinetic energy. They come because there's immense energy associated with this kinetic energy of these protons traveling so fast. So they're not really, you know, they're not really considered fundamental to the protons' identities, these transient quarks. So therefore they're called extrinsic quarks. It's kind of like J. The essence of J, this essence of J does not have to include meatballs, but they often can be found inside of J when he's in what I call the J food collider. Okay. Now, meatballs then are extrinsic to J. On the other hand, having no butt is clearly fundamental to the J-ness of J. So that would be called intrinsic and not extrinsic. So, okay. So this idea of intrinsic quarks then have been theorized for decades. And that means that the more massive quarks, like the charm quark, could at times appear within the proton and when it's in this baseline state, right? So you've got a proton that's not traveling at near the speed of light, and they could potentially find these heavy charm quarks inside of it. And so then that would not be extrinsic. And this would be an example of an intrinsic quark. Now, this would be these intrinsic quarks then are a fundamental part of protons if they exist. These intrinsic quarks that are not up or down, but are heavy and kind of fleeting and rare, they could potentially be a fundamental part of the protons. You know, similar in a way to the way that the up and down quarks that have low mass are fundamental. And you look at every physics textbook and it'll say, oh yeah, these protons, you know, these quarks, so you have up and down quarks and the protons are neutrons. They all say it, but maybe if these intrinsic quarks are real, then that's going to have to change. Now, another way to express this intrinsic nature is to say that the charm quark would be part of the wave function of the proton, which means that it would be part of this fundamental identity of what a proton is, if it's in there. So then this new research that I'm talking about is about this search for these new intrinsic quarks that may be part of protons. And the icing on the cake for all of this research that I've gone through is that they used artificial intelligence and it played a critical role. That was really like one of the deciding factors. Like, yeah, I want to talk about this because not only is the whole quark angle fascinating, but of course they used AI, which is great. So to do that, they took massive volumes of the particle collider data from the LHC and from other colliders, and they added that to theoretical calculations that they had done as well. And they used the AI software to analyze all that data. So for the analysis, they used a machine learning model that essentially built a hypothetical proton structure itself. And that included within that structure the charm quark, of course. So it has the structure that has the charm quark embedded within this structure, and then it compared that to all the collider data. So that's what it did. And when it was all said and done, the results claimed that charm quarks carry 0.62% of a proton's momentum. But the confidence levels for now are 3 sigma. And if we've discussed this before, that means that there's a 0.3% chance their results are just a coincidence. So it's, you know, it's not, there's not a great chance, but it's not good enough. And we all know by now that if you really want to get noticed, you're going to have to get to a level 5 sigma before the quark quarks would pop and they could claim a conclusive result that would be accepted by the scientific community and maybe even go get their Nobels as well. Since we're talking about the quantum realm, I have to point out that one of the bizarre ramifications of this theory that I mentioned briefly at the top of this is that if this does prove correct, charm quarks, then they're much more massive than the up and down quarks. If they do appear within protons from time to time. That would mean that the proton would get more massive, right? In fact, if you add the mass of a charm quark into a proton, it would increase its mass by a whopping 50%, something that would be hard not to notice. But, of course, as we know, the quantum realm doesn't work that way. It's not obvious. It's not intuitive. You can't simply just add the individual masses up within a proton and expect that to be its final mass. You silly, decohered macroscale humans. Doesn't work that way. The bottom line, then, is that once in a while, a proton, if this is true, a proton will contain a charm quark that's heavier than the entire proton itself. And the universe just is like, we're not going to really... That's not going to really happen. And it doesn't, you know, so it's counterintuitive. It's hard to wrap your head around it, but that's how it works. So looking into the future, so what's going to happen with this in the future? Well, first off, I think they're going to get that to 5 sigma. I hope they can get it up there. And then they will have conclusive proof that these charm quarks can be an intrinsic part of protons. I'll end it with a quote from theoretical physicist Juan Rojo. He's from the University of Amsterdam. He said, the recent research is just the start of a long-term research program that aims to unveil the possible existence of other intrinsic heavy quarks in the proton. And this could help answer what determines the mass of the proton, one of the major open questions in physics. So imagine in the future, if not only they show that charm quarks are intrinsically part of protons, but also the other strange and top and bottom quarks are also those other super heavy, and they're super heavy. They're many, many times heavier than protons. So that would be even more kind of counterintuitive that they could potentially exist fundamentally within protons, but also be much more massive, which is so quantum of it, right?
That's so quantum.
So quantum. So just a fascinating idea. I've heard of these intrinsic and extrinsic quarks before, and this really helps solidify that in my mind. It's fascinating because there's so much going on inside that proton. It is so not just, here's a few quarks and some gluons. It's so there's so much more going on, and I'm just scratching the surface. If you like any of this stuff, look it up. It's endlessly fascinating.
All right, cool. Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
All right, guys, last week I played this noisy. You guys have any guesses?
That's easy. That's my electric toothbrush.
Yeah, I have no idea.
Steve?
It's an artificial vocal cord.
Interesting.
Not a bad guess. So there was a lot of really, really good guesses this week. So, you know, I guess the reveal is going to happen relatively quickly on this. But Jim Kelly wrote in and said, "Hi, Jay, this week's noisy reminds me of overtone singing, a.k.a. throat singing, where the singer changes the resonances of the vocal resonances. Of the vocal track to make it seem like they're producing multiple separate notes." So Jim, you're not wrong, but you're not completely correct. I'll leave it at that because, you know, I'll tell you the whole thing in a second. Brian Fort wrote in and said, "Hey Jay, it sounds like an artificial throat that is changing its aperture to create various harmonics like a Tibetan throat singer." Again, close, very close. Lots of good stuff in there. Not correct enough though. All right, this next one was sent in by a listener named Jeff Lotz, and Jeff says, hey Jay, first time guessing, long time listener and patron, ding, ding, ding. This sounds like someone building up an electronic buzzer sound by adding successive Fourier components. It could even be a square wave, which has a very buzzer-like sound. So when he says Fourier, he's talking essentially about there are pure tones and then there are overtones. And I think in this context, he's talking about collections of overtones, which adds to the puzzle here. So Jeff is not correct, but it adds a little bit more info, which I just find this very interesting. So we had many people guess correctly. I got a few people here that guessed correctly in different ways. So one person guessed named Joshua Twilley. Joshua said, "Hey, Dear Jay, you rock. This week's noisy sounds very much like a recording of a human voice that has been put through sinusoidal partial editing and resynthesis. Here is the hypothesis. Sinusoidal. Yeah. The original audio file has been put through a piece of software that deconstructed the sound wave into component sine waves. I'm not going to read the whole thing that he said, but that could very well be what this sound is. So you did answer correctly. He says the noisy starts off with many of the original sounds, partial overtones removed. You know, so a lot of the things that he put in there is absolutely correct. So that's a win. Shane Hillier wrote in, this week sounds like a speaker layering overtones in such a way that causes acoustic beating that sounds similar to human vocal utterances. I thought that was good enough as well. And an interesting way is like you could simulate the human voice by adding in certain overtones is what he was saying. And then another listener named Nathan McDonald also guessed correctly. So anyway, let me get to what this is. So I will say right out of the gate, I don't know exactly how these sounds were generated. They could have very well been a normal human voice that, you know, software picked apart all of the components that make up a human voice. But let me explain to you what you're hearing and what is a human voice. Like, why do our voices sound the way that they sound? Well, there are core tones in our voice that basically make the root or the bulk of our voice. And then there's something called overtones. And overtones are other frequencies that are mixed in. They, you know, absolutely have something to do with the shape of your throat, the size of your throat, the shape of your head, the shape and size of your nasal cavity, you know, the ways that the density of your bones actually affect the sound that comes out of your mouth. You know, you have vocal cords and, you know, it's basically like, your vocal cords are one thing, and then you have other parts of your throat that add to the sound of your voice. There's skin and folds of skin and tissue in your throat that do these things. It's very complicated from a physics perspective. But what's happening is there are tons of overtones that are being created, right? So the bass sound is coming off of your vocal cords and all these other resonances are adding to it. So when you hear this noisy, in the beginning, you're hearing like some very, very basic parts of the human voice. And when you hear the tinkling sounds, right, those little chimey sounds, they're adding in more and more overtones and it becomes more and more human sounding until the end, it's a complete human voice that's making, you know, an ah sound. So listen again, listen for those little chimes that come in when they're adding in overtones. And you'll hear this thing start off as very non-human sounding and it becomes completely human sounding because of the overtones. So I find this absolutely fascinating, right? You're not just hearing a single tone. Like if you ever listen to a single tone, you could easily do this, go online. You can hear someone play, you know, a synthesizer that's just playing literally one tone. And it sounds so two-dimensional. It sounds so flat. There's no life to it. But when, you know, any instrument that's played, essentially anything that makes sound, will have overtones into it that gives it its characteristics, that makes it sound the way it sounds. Why does like one guitar sound different than the next? It's a complicated question, but one of the things is basically the vibration and the way that musical instrument resonates and creates overtones. So overtones are everything, most everything creates overtones. But I got to tell you, the human voice, when you hear this noisy and hear the construction of a person saying, ah, ah, those overtones get added in and it becomes a human voice by the addition of further and further overtones. My God, that is so cool. It's such an interesting phenomenon that's going on. And it's happening every time you talk. You're shooting tons and tons of overtones, which essentially is like, remember the piano one I did a few weeks ago where you hear a voice in the piano?
Yeah. That's what you're doing.
That's what's happening. If you think about it, there could be hundreds or thousands of overtones that are added in to give something a sound, right? The piano could be marginally sound like a human voice because you could add in like hundreds of notes that add in these overtones that build up the sound. Profile the sound characteristic. So cool. Just look it up. There's tons of stuff on the web about that. I love it. I can keep going forever. I have a new Noisy. This Noisy was sent in by me.
Okay.
Right?
Self-referral.
I did because I try not to repeat things. You know, I try to be as unique as possible. But there are themes that I really love. And one of them is what the one that this slips into. What classification does this particular sound fall into? Some of you, a lot of you will know immediately what the classification is, but I want to know exactly where this is from, what it's from, and be as specific as you possibly can in the paradigm of what this is. Tell me exactly when this sound happens. That's my clue. Kara, do you want to hear it again?
Yes.
Just out of curiosity, does that sound familiar to any of you?
Big.
Yeah. Yeah.
Don't you love that? Like that head scratching, yeah. Like, where did I hear that? What's that from? That's exactly the way I want you to feel. So if you feel that way, email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org. And you can also send me in some cool sounds that you heard. Steve, there are things happening.
Yep.
In the world of SGU.
That's correct.
That I would like to go over with you right now. So one, I want to remind people that Nexus happened and it's not too late. You could always buy tickets to Nexus and view it for months and months. I actually think the last 2 years are still up right now. We didn't take them down because I still see people going back and watching talks from there. So we just leave them up. If you're interested, we had an incredible keynote speaker situation. We had Bill Nye and David Copperfield, and their conversation was a ton of fun to listen to. These two guys went on well over an hour discussing different things about their lives and experiences and about misinformation. I thought it was a really, really cool and fun talk to listen to. Another quick thing is we are going to be in Phoenix, Arizona and Tucson, Arizona doing extravaganzas and private shows. Extravaganza is a stage show. There's a lot of stand-up improv comedy things that we do, and we're also teaching you about how you cannot trust your human perception. The show is a lot of fun. It runs about 2 hours, and we're going to be doing a show in Phoenix and a show in Tucson. We are also doing two private shows, and these are special private shows because they're private show pluses, which means that we spend an extra hour with the audience. We do a live SGU recording, and then we will stay an extra hour just to hang out and socialize and do some fun things with the audience. You can get all the information on these shows by going to theskepticsguide.org/events.
All right. Thanks, Jay. We have a dumbest thing of the week. This is a comment left on a blog post of mine about climate change, and it was so dumb, I had to share it with everyone. I won't say the commenter's name, but he writes, "Nobody competent in chemistry believes the political BS about each element in the human DNA being a pollutant. Nitrogen is over 75% of the atmosphere, but turns into a pollutant once it hits the dirt. Once it hits the ground, only a dirt worshiper would think so. Carbon is the basic building block of all life on Earth. Oxygen, the larger part of CO2, is not a pollutant, even when combined with hydrogen as H2O, where it becomes the largest greenhouse gas in the atmosphere. So go ahead, humor your politically correct self, and believe political hacks that the very elements that make up your DNA are the biggest problematic pollution on Earth."
Oh.
Yeah.
Yikes. So what's, a lot to unpack there.
Yeah. Steve, do we even have time to talk about this?
What's the core logical fallacy in there?
Is it the naturalistic? What's it called? I always screw up the title.
Appeal to nature
one.
Fallacy? No.
Yeah, the appeal to nature. Oh, okay. Not like it's in you. So
I mean,
it's fine.
Yeah, I mean, sort of. That's not the core fallacy. That's woven in there a little bit. So
what am I not seeing?
It's a fallacy of division. It's like when you say that, like when you confuse different levels of organization, like the pieces all have the properties of the whole or vice versa. It's ironic that he starts with, pontificating about being competent in chemistry and then makes the dumbest chemistry third grader mistake possible of confusing the properties of elements with the properties of compounds that contain those elements.
Right.
Right. So yet nitrogen is in our DNA. Therefore, nothing that contains nitrogen can possibly be a pollutant.
I know that's bananas. Like
it's bananas. Yeah.
Like we breathe air. Therefore, if I put an air embolism in your vein, you wouldn't die. Like it's just, it doesn't make any sense. You can't just transfer even not just in quantity, but just an application. Some things are toxic when they're used a certain way.
But it's also when you combine different elements together, they have different chemical
properties.
Right. I mean, that's how chemistry works. I mean, that's a
that's the fundamental aspect of chemistry. Yeah, you cannot judge a chemical based upon its elemental constituents, right? I said, someone else opened up with, so, you know, cyanide's okay then, right? I mean, it's just hydrogen and nitrogen and stuff. I said, yeah, would you drink benzene? That's just carbon and hydrogen. How about formaldehyde? That's CH2O. It's water with a perfectly natural carbon attached to it. That actually makes it healthier. So drink a boatload of formaldehyde. It's nonsense. Like, but this guy is like not, he's getting, you know, judgmental about like calling climate change scientists pseudoscientists because they don't understand what. I mean, what is he saying? You know, that's like saying everything contains quarks and quarks are natural. Yeah, there's quarks in water. You know, so anything with quarks is fine. You know, can't possibly be bad. And I think he's confusing. He's also making there's also a straw man in there, which I know only because of other comments that he left. Because he's also trying to say that when, like, people talk about like reducing the amount of carbon we release into the atmosphere, that they're talking literally about carbon and not carbon dioxide.
Right. Yeah.
It's like no one believes that. It's only a problem when it's carbon dioxide. You know, when it's part. That's what they're talking about. It's just shorthand.
They think there's just like charcoal.
Again, he's just projecting the worst possible straw man. Yeah, you know, and then making an even worse, you know, gaffe himself. It's just
mind
numbing. All right, but here's the thing: he didn't invent this. You know where he got all this from?
Where? Who?
Mike Adams.
Oh boy,
he's parroting Mike Adams. Mm. So this you know meme is out there.
That's pretty sad.
He's not even original in his ignorance.
Yeah.
Do you know what that reminds me of, Steve? I just made a weird connection in my head. Have you guys seen, I think it's on Hulu, there's a New York Times documentary. They just did one all about Mercola and anti-vax and how dangerous it is. It's great. It's like this great, super skeptical, awesome, ultra mainstream. I think it was a New York Times documentary. It may have been ABC or something. But yeah, it's really good. Check it out. Okay, so it's called The New York Times Presents Super Spreader.
Yeah.
And it's all about super spreading misinformation.
Awesome.
On COVID. Yeah, it's really great. You can see it on Hulu. It just came out on August 19th. Highly recommend you guys.
Thanks. Sounds great.
Mm-hmm. All right, guys. It's time for science or fiction.
Yay!
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items for facts, two genuine and one fictitious, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. And there's a theme this week, because of course there is. And what do you think that theme is?
Florence. Yeah, Italy. Definitely
Italy.
Florence. Specifically Florence. Okay?
See, now you're going to make me feel bad, Steve.
All right, here we go. Item number one. Florence Nightingale, the founder of modern nursing, was named after the city of her birth, Florence, Italy. Item number two, when the Nazis were fleeing Italy during World War II, Hitler ordered all the bridges of Florence to be destroyed to slow the Alliance advance. However, the private tasked with setting the charges on the Ponte Vecchio deliberately failed to make a proper connection, sparing the bridge. And item number three, in 1527, anti-Medici rioters dropped a bench from a parapet, striking Michelangelo's David and breaking off his left arm in three pieces. Kara, have you ever been to Florence?
No. I've only been to Venice in Italy.
Yeah, only Venice, huh?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know it's weird. It's a weird city to only have been to.
Yeah.
So does that mean I get to go first?
Yes, you go first.
Okay. All right. These all are like totally believable and also completely unbelievable. Florence Nightingale... obviously we know of her, was named because she was born in Florida. Who does that? I have a friend named Austin who was born in like Houston, I think, which is weird.
Austin from Houston?
Yeah, I think so. He's not from Austin, but he's definitely from Texas. And then this middle one has so many details. When the Nazis were fleeing Italy during World War II, Hitler ordered all the bridges of Florence to be destroyed. Nazis fled Italy? Wait, what? I didn't even know that happened. Did the Nazis...
Yeah, remember when they lost World War II? Remember when that happened?
I just remember, like, but they already had, like, these fascist allies. Why did they also have to be in Italy? I didn't realize that they were. Ugh, I'm so confused. Private tasked with setting the charges deliberately failed to make a proper connection and save the bridge. I mean, that seems believable. And then this last one, anti-Medici rioters dropped a bench. Why a bench? Oh, I'm assuming this would, well, it says rioter, so it maybe was on accident, but maybe it was intentional. That sucks. I've never seen David up close. I'm assuming they would have just, like, I don't know, what would they have, glued it back together?
Yeah, a little super glue.
Oh my goodness. I don't know. I'm going to say that the one with all the detail is the fiction, because there are too many things that could go wrong there. So I'm going to say it's the Nazis fleeing and the bridge, but then the bridge actually didn't blow up. But this is a total, just like, I threw the dart at the dartboard with my back turned towards it.
Okay, Bob?
I feel like I would have heard about David and breaking of his arm. Three pieces. I'm going to say that one. I feel I would have heard about that, because that would have been such a horrible thing. The Ponte Vecchio one, I just want to believe that that happened. So I'm just going to say that one's science. And Florence Nightingale, yeah, whatever. I'm sure it's possible. So I'll go with the anti-Medici rioters fiction.
Okay, and Jay.
I mean, I'm pretty damn sure that David had the statue of David had a couple of things happen to it. One of them was that somebody hit David's toe with a hammer. Did you guys ever hear about that?
Mm-mm.
Yeah, that rings a bell, Jay. I think I just read yep. where I Why just would made they have a false done memory. That?
Some crazy dude.
Oh, okay. That's not cool.
Yeah. Now they have to put metal detectors in all the exhibits and everything.
The other toes.
Crazy people from destroying stuff. As far as David's arm breaking, I'm pretty damn sure that happened.
Mm.
Shit.
Yeah, they have people that can fix problems like that, you know? And then Florence Nightingale, you know, I'm pretty sure that her name was because that she was born in Florence, Italy. I'm not 100% sure about that. And the reason why I think number two is fiction is because, one, I absolutely would have heard about it if this story existed, because I love World War II and I love Italy and I love the Ponte Vecchio. So I can't imagine, through all of my reading about all of these things, that I would not have heard of it, right? I have to kind of go off of that, because these are things that I am interested in, that I feel like I have a little bit of a base of knowledge about. So I'm definitely going to say that that one's the fake.
All right, so you all agree with the first one, so we'll start there. Florence Nightingale, the founder of modern nursing, was named after the city of her birth, Florence, Italy. Now, you guys remember that she was a British nurse, right?
That's correct.
I do now.
Oh, well, then it would make more sense. Yeah, then it makes more sense that they would name her that.
Yeah, she was named after Florence, Italy, where she was born. Amazing, amazing woman. This is, like, we don't talk about her enough. I mean, she really is the founder of modern nursing. I mean, she was in she was a British Army nurse, mainly came to fame during the Crimean War. And she's completely revolutionized the modern hospital, like introducing things like cleaning the bed sheets between patients and, you know, like basic hygiene and all kinds of, you know, safety regulations that we take for granted now. It was all her.
Yeah.
I mean, she literally wrote the book and transformed hospital care, first in the military, but then, of course, spreading throughout the world. So absolutely amazing. Okay, let's go to number two. When the Nazis were fleeing Italy during World War II, Hitler ordered all the bridges of Florence to be destroyed to slow the Allied advance. However, the private tasked with setting the charges on the Ponte Vecchio deliberately failed to make a proper connection, sparing the bridge. Now, Jay, I know you've seen the Ponte Vecchio. Bob, I know you saw it at least. When's the last time you saw it?
94, I think.
Yeah, and I just saw it, of course, last week. And, of course, it's intact and ancient, so it clearly was not destroyed in World War II, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the question is, how did that come about? How was it not destroyed? And yes, Kara, the Nazis occupied Italy, as an ally, and then the allies starting in Northern Africa, then coming up through Sicily, pushed the Nazis out of Italy. When they fled Rome,
mm-hmm.
they basically the allied forces overwhelmed the Germans, and they declared Rome an open city, which means no fighting there. So they didn't have to blow up the bridges there. But then what the Allied forces did was they took advantage of that. They stormed right over one of the bridges and captured like a whole battalion of Nazi forces. And so
Sneaky. Then
they moved north to Florence, and they were like, nope, we're not going to let them do it this time. We're going to blow up all the bridges. And they did blow up all the bridges except the Ponte Vecchio. But why did they not blow up the Ponte Vecchio? It wasn't because of a private. This one is the fiction. It's possible that the order to spare the Ponte Vecchio came from Hitler himself, but we know for sure.
Nice guy.
Yeah, but we're pretty sure that the ranking officer in Florence, who was in charge of the withdrawal, essentially Hitler said, "Don't destroy anything, you know, historically significant, you know, when you're fleeing Florence." Because Hitler was there for a while, and he liked the city, thought it was beautiful, he loved the Ponte Vecchio. So we don't know exactly where the orders came from, but it was basically up the chain. Everyone was like, yeah, we're not going to blow up the Ponte Vecchio. But it's also the fact that American tanks couldn't fit across the bridge, so we weren't going to use it anyway. So they didn't have to blow it up. That was a factor as well. But yeah, there was no... You know, if they wanted to blow up the bridge, they would have blown up the bridge. You know, even if somebody, the first, you know, thing didn't work, you know, they would have just kept going. But anyway, yeah, that came from higher up, the order to spare the Ponte Vecchio. All the other bridges were over the Arno were blown up, though. All this means that in 1527, anti-Medici rioters dropped a bench from a parapet, striking Michelangelo's David and breaking off his left arm in three pieces is science. That happened. Don't know if it was deliberate or an accident. They were up there. They were throwing furniture at the forces, the guards, you know, the police, basically. And one of the pieces of furniture struck David, which was in the Piazza Signorina at the time, where, quote-unquote, fake David is now. We call that the Piazza Fake David because there's a copy of David in there. And that's where the original David was when this happened. And then there were later assaults on David. Then they moved it into the Academy Museum where it is now, beautifully placed. I mean, it's, you know, they come around the corner. It's like wonderfully. The where it is like part of its, you know, of its charm.
David was so critically important to the people of Florence. Like it became the symbol of the city. And I like to think, Steve, that when that happened, that everybody just stopped for a minute. We're like, oh, shit. You know what I mean? Because that's not cool.
To protect it, not, you know.
I just Googled David and zoomed into his left arm. I think I can even see where it was repaired.
It's pretty seamless. I didn't notice it when I was there. Other mishaps. 1512, damage to the base by lightning. 1813, broken finger on the right hand. 1843, a broken toe. And then the incident that Jay was talking about. In 1991, a disturbed Italian artist attacks the toe on the left foot with a hammer, saying he had been instructed to do so by La Bella Nana, the exquisitely beautiful model who posed for the 16th century Venetian painter Paolo Veronese. Nut job. So they had to protect it. Not as bad as the Pietà, yeah, with the 80s or something. Some deranged person goes in there and just hammered it to pieces. They had to put that thing together like a puzzle.
Jeez.
And now it's behind glass. You can't get anywhere near it. The arm pieces were put together by copper nails on David. And, of course, they fixed it to make it as seamless as possible. And it was good.
It looks pristine.
It does.
To think that that statue was outside in the weather.
Yeah.
You know?
What were they thinking? But, yeah, now it's perfectly positioned now. That was
what an awesome sight seeing him up close.
Yeah.
Your jaw just drops and doesn't close for a while.
What's funny, so we were all looking at David, and I had over the years read a lot about David, and so you looked at the expression on his face, and I always read that like it showed, you know, fear. Like he's looking at Goliath and he shows it on his face. But when you look at him from the ground, he looks pretty chill, you know?
Yeah, he definitely does. He looks serene.
Does it depend on the angle you look at him?
Yeah. Totally. If you are at eye level with him, so I've seen pictures at eye level, you can see the furrowed brows, and he is shitting his pants that he's not wearing right then.
I don't know, Steve. I've thought about this quite a bit, too. The main question I have is this a snapshot of David before or after he beat Goliath.
Right before. He's looking at Goliath. He has the sling over his arm. He's putting the stone in the sling with his right hand. He's looking at David, and he's shitting a brick.
Oh, that's yeah. He definitely happening. Looks concerned when you look at
yes.
I'm just Googling David statue at eye level, and it's a completely different look. That's
yeah,
nuts.
But from the ground, he looks totally chill.
Yeah, and that's how we all see it, is looking up at it.
Yeah, it's wow. interesting.
I read that his head is a little bit bigger than normal for when he was, because I think when it was initially displayed, it was like on the ceiling, on the roof of some structure, was like high. And so to make him look more, you know, to scale, more.
Yeah.
That
because it's so big, you need
he made
to,
his
need
head a little bit bigger.
Yeah.
And yeah. of course, his right
the hand. Hands
is
are a little bit bigger.
Clay,
as
yeah,
well.
That's always. Oh, cool. Most people talk about that. The, especially the right hand is clearly yeah.
absolutely
a little
absolute
bit too big. But, and Steve, I remember when the last time I was there, I think in 94, I remember looking at scores and scores of these little David statues that I wanted to buy to do some justice to David. And nobody, not one that I saw, did the big sculpture
they're all
justice. They're all yeah, just like a weird it. Expression on his face. Nobody could catch his face at all at
yeah,
a small scale.
Yeah.
I remember not, no one did.
I would, yeah. I could
get a 3D
like
print that damn thing.
Yeah.
There's something remarkable about how things of beauty, whether it's art or natural things, that they do something to us.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think about it, like it's interesting to think about it, like why did we evolve? If we did, I think we did because it's powerful. There might be a really good reason why we're affected by things of beauty like this.
I think it's an epiphenomenon. We obviously evolved emotions, you know, for evolutionary advantages. Again, it's hard to tease that all apart, but I mean, those are evolved emotions and art just exploits those, right? I don't think we didn't evolve to appreciate the piano. We evolved to appreciate regularity and, you know, mathematical precision and, you know, and interpreting the emotion of voices. Like, and then, you know, artistry is translating all of that, the human experience, like how we process things like that.
Oh, what a funny thought.
Into an artistic experience, you know.
And you can go one level further, because I remember talking once about when I first left religion, and I was reflecting back on all the time I spent in the Mormon church, and I used to really love singing, and I was in the choir, and I actually remember listening to religious music and being like, I feel the spirit in me. And then I looked back and I was like, oh no, I just really like music. Like music is just very emotional for me. So it's funny that even another layer deeper than that, people can ascribe almost like supernatural or metaphysical kind of properties to that, because it is so evocative and it makes
Bob and
you
I were talking
feel
about this
so
recently.
Much. Yeah.
Yeah. Bob and I were talking about this recently. We both have this really like intense emotional reaction to certain pieces of music, mm-hmm. especially when paired with the correct video,
like
when you have that combination of emotions in a film with the right music behind it supporting it, it's really powerful. And that's just wired in us, like it's just
and sometimes I'm like, but I don't want to cry about this. Why?
Right.
Why? What's happening?
Why are you manipulating me, you bastard? but it is it's a wonderful, powerful experience.
Yeah.
All right, Evan's not here, so I did a quote. The quote is, what we call rational grounds for our beliefs are often extremely irrational attempts to justify our instincts. I thought that was appropriate given my news item. Mm-hmm. And that phrase was written by one of my favorite philosophers, Thomas Henry Huxley.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, he got it.
Tommy.
All right, guys. Well, good job, Jay and Kara, on the science of fiction.
Yay.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And thank you all for joining me this week.
You got it, Steve.
Go Quarks.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.